Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And as you'll know if you follow this podcast, I've been doing over the course of the last year various podcasts on the topic of everyday life in post-war America, or the 40s and 50s particularly, and what it was like to be living during a time of unprecedented increases in material well-being. American people at the end of the Second World War had memories of the Great Depression and of wartime rationing and austerity fresh in their minds, and yet within a decade they were living in a country that had half the world's wealth and 5% of the world's population, and a country that had experienced advances in material wealth unknown, really, in this kind of rapidity and abundance in human history. America, at the end of the Second World War, was not only the richest country in the world, but the richest country in the history of the world. Now, any geography student will tell you that gross domestic product does not equal gross domestic product per capita, that huge influxes of wealth into a country are not, by their very nature, equally shared, and as we've already discussed many, many times before, for the most part, Black Americans, Latino Americans, and other minorities didn't share particularly in this newfound prosperity. This was truly was the era of mass consumption, and it's no mistake that much of the art and culture that emerges throughout this period really reflects this explosion in consumption and the amount of resources that are available to ordinary Americans. If you look at the film and television of the 50s and 60s, these are almost kind of showcases to new mass consumption societies, from everything all the way down to cartoons like the Jetsons and the Flintstones. They talk about abundance within suburbia, even for kind of the working class characters within things like, for example, the Flintstones and that sort of thing. Historian Fred Siegel says, "A good deal of what had once seemed science fiction became everyday life." This is obviously from Grand Expectations, James Patterson's excellent history of America, 1945-74. James Patterson says, "In the 5 years after the war, Americans were presented with such new items as the automatic car transmission, the electric clothes dryer, the long-playing record, the Polaroid camera, the automatic garbage disposal unit." If you read Never Had It So Good, Dominic Sandbrook's History of Britain from 1956 to 1964, then you see a kind of an equivalent sort of story. The post-war boom in Britain takes about another 5 years in order to manifest itself. The post-war boom in America is really in evidence at the end of the 1940s. It takes until the mid-1950s really for Britain to take off in much the same way. Very good economic and historical reasons for that. But they both tell a similar kind of story. Both books tell a similar kind of story about Britain and America, respectively. And you find a similar explosion in mass consumption happening throughout most of the world that A, haven't been defeated in the Second World War, or B, that had managed to stave off most of the ravages of war. However, even in France, Italy and other European countries rebuilding themselves, once again there is a consumption takeoff. Now, one of the things I've long suspected is this explosion in consumption in living standards that marked the 50s and then the 1960s has cast a long shadow over pretty much everything else. When you look at disgruntled and angry middle and working class people across the Western world, pointing back to a kind of mythologized heyday long before the ravages of neoliberalism, this is the era they point back to, assuming that it can be endlessly replicated. Now, maybe it can, maybe it can't. That's perhaps for economists to discuss. Or it's entirely possible that this explosion in consumption and material well-beings was a historical one-off and not something that current conditions can perhaps replicate. It's a slightly different conversation altogether with other different implications attached to it. The new levels of innovation seemed to really stand out in this period. Frozen food, for example, which was for the first time marketed widely, treated with great suspicion in some quarters to begin with. Plastics, nylon, polythene and cellophane, styrofoam cups, vinyl floor covering, the plastic bag, plastic toys for children. All of these came from the invention of this incredibly useful, incredibly durable, and now we see incredibly problematic substance, PET, polyethyl tetrachloride, that has been the main building block of that and the silicon chip, I suppose, of post-war society. James Patterson states, between 1939 and 1948, clothes sales jumped threefold, furniture fourfold, jewellery fourfold, liquor fivefold, and household appliances, including TV, fivefold. Now, between 1941 and 1945, for four of those years, obviously, rationing made most of that impossible. So probably the jump in material well-being happened not between 1939 and 48. Most of what we've talked about there, clothing sales jumping threefold, furniture jumping fourfold, would have happened between 1945 and 1948. The car is the object that really is synonymous with new post-war prosperity and affluence. Car sales were 69,500 in 1945. The following year, they leap from that to 2.1 million. And that's really got more to do with the drag factor of the war in 1945 than dramatic increases in productive capacity. Most aircraft factories had originally been used for manufacturing things like cars. Turning a car engine into an aircraft engine, a fighter aircraft engine, is a relatively straightforward transition. We did talk in the podcast a while back about American rearmament and about American manufacturers desperate for Roosevelt to give the green light so they could start to retool their plants as quickly as possible. And the process of turning a peacetime economy into a wartime economy is very difficult, but transitioning backwards, it appears, has proven to be a lot easier. The American government, if you read Anthony Sampson's brilliant book, The Arms Bazaar, the aircraft industry in California collapses in 1945, only to be quickly revived with huge government subsidies thereafter and defence spending, which is a great way of keeping otherwise obsolete industries that are strategically useful full of life. In 1949, car sales hit 5.1 million. And this was a record-breaking level of sales. The previous high point had been 1929. So that shows you again, if the previous high point had been 1929, that shows you the effects of the Great Depression throughout the 1930s and the war. By 1950, sales had gone up to 6.7 million. And in 1955, they reached 7.9 million. And this is where many people in America believe that there had been some kind of take-off point in terms of living standards, and that living standards would only ever increase exponentially. The demand for cars was predicated on two things mainly. The flight of white Americans to suburbia, necessitating car use for people to get to work, and suburbia being spread out, you can only really navigate it by a car, getting to the shops and that kind of thing, and getting back and that sort of business. But also, it's predicated on cheap oil. Now, in the 1970s, two oil shocks in one decade will cause terrific crisis in American suburbia. And there would be a sense of gloom over the decade that something terribly wrong was going terribly wrong with the American dream. One of the things that's going wrong is that the American dream, if there is such a thing, was built on cheap oil. And after the two oil shocks, it's never quite that cheap again. Most of the cars that were purchased in America by the 1950s were American built. There were very few Volkswagens, and American cars of the 1950s were large. They had 8 cylinders, 100-horsepower engines, radios, heaters, lights. They were works of art, as I'm sure anybody with an interest in classic cars know. And they were statements of kind of post-war American affluence and identity. You have Chevrolets and Studebakers, looking not dissimilar from the kind of imaginings of spaceships. You know, those are almost slightly modelled on kind of the cartoon versions of spaceships, and again, things like the Jetsons, which I keep referencing. And the big three car companies, General Motors, Chrysler and Ford, dominated the market. Cars were relatively expensive, and in relation to family incomes, and new Chevys and Fords started at the price tag of about $1,300, which was 2/5 of the median family income at that time. The transition to a car-owning society, to an automobile society, obviously has huge structural implications for downtown areas, for places that had normally been accessed by bus, for the railroad industry, but for gas stations, for the oil business, for trucking stops, for roadside hotels and motels, the entire transitory culture of America in the second half of the 20th century, this flourishes because of this boom in car.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ownership. And the suburban shopping mall dramatically booms as well. There were 8 in 1946 and 4,000 a decade later. In the 1920s, cars had developed and changed patterns of living, and they did so again in the 1950s, and they were part of the driver of economic change within society, reshaping it and reforming it in this way that kind of capitalism tends to do, tearing up things, and throwing up the pieces and starting with something new. This also, cars also powered the development of America's post-war construction industry and the building of new cities that previously could have been inconceivable without cars developed in particularly the west coast of America. Millions of former servicemen and their families had decided to decamp to California for the warm weather and the quality of life. And much of the new building was single-family homes in American suburbia. There was some subsidised apartment building for poorer people, which received congressional subsidies. But new single-family homes in 1944, there had been 114,000 of them. 2 years later, this rises to nearly a million, with 937,000, and 1.7 million a year in 1950. 15 million houses were added to the total stock of housing in America between 1945 and 55, which led to another thing that's going to shape post-war America and shape mentalities and ideas and beliefs that American people had, which was record high levels of home ownership. Generally, and this is a generalisation, but generally, home ownership tends to convey onto large swathes of the population a certain degree of faith and reassurance and belief in the pre-established rules of the system. Again, across the Western world at the moment, housing is extremely expensive, and trying to sell the story of capitalism to people that cannot afford to own any capital is rather difficult. By 1960, 60% of all Americans owned their homes, though that increase was only 10% on 1945, when half of all Americans did. So a lot of this was as the result of government action. It's very unlikely, normally very rare, for the wonders of market forces left on their own simply to be responsible for these kinds of things. Normally governments actually have to kind of engineer dramatic social change one way or another. Congress had authorised increased spending for home loans by the Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration. So this was part of the GI Bill of Rights of 1944. And so this huge influx of cash into the system made it easier for people to access credit than at any time before. The terms of the loans are very, very generous, especially if you compare that to what private industry was or private banking was prepared to offer. Particularly before the war. In 1939, prospective homeowners had to put down huge sums of money, half the value of the home or more, and to pay off the mortgages extremely quickly. This really precluded or excluded large numbers of people from home ownership. The Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration were offering loans of up to 90% of the value of the property and allowing 30 years for the mortgage to be paid off. Interest rates were around 4 to 4.5%, so comparatively low, and the Veterans Administration allowed veterans to purchase homes with basically no down payment. This was an investment in post-war social stability. There are numerous examples of large numbers of soldiers returning from wartime to peacetime and being not taken care of in a particularly humane or forward-thinking way, and all sorts of trouble emerging as a result. At the time of the Cold War, the idea of American prosperity, the idea of American egalitarian politics, the idea that capitalism works not just for the rich but for everybody, this had to really be put into practice and shown, and there was a concern that poverty in America might well undermine some of the key claims of capitalist society. It was private builders that made the houses, and this influx of cash into the system stimulated the private building industry, who struggled to actually keep up with demand. For example, in Chicago, the housing development Park Forest was planned for the city, and it was meant to house 30,000 people. The builders, William Levitt and his brother Alfred, who were a salesman and an architect respectively, had been fairly small-time guys until the Second World War. And then they saw the opportunities that production line techniques and production line technologies could afford them. And so mass production of housing was by the Levitt brothers, an innovation based on observations of wartime planning and procedures. They began to apply the expertise they'd learned to suburban housing. The lumber came from forests that they themselves had purchased. They created a kind of like a vertically integrated system to keep the costs as low as possible. They also made all their own nails and cement. They hired non-union workers to keep strikes low, and prevent strikes, and paid them higher than normal unionised workers would get. They paid them above wage scales. The Levitt brothers formed workers into teams and carefully defined each task, much as Henry Ford had done on the Ford motor car production lines. At the peak times, using pre-assembled materials and pre-assembled planning material systems, they could put a house together in 16 minutes. And the very first Levitt town emerged on potato fields that were 30 miles outside New York City at Hempstead on Long Island. And the Levitt town at Hempstead was the largest single housing development put up in one go by an American builder. It lasted for 50 years and had 17,000 homes and accommodated over 80,000 people. The Levitt town had 7 village greens and shopping centres, 14 playgrounds, 9 swimming pools, 2 bowling alleys, and a town hall. And the Levitts sold the land at cost for schools and donated spaces for churches and fire stations, which gives you an indication of how much profit they must have made from it. Other Levitt towns were created in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and Willingboro, New Jersey. These were almost as vast. Levitt towners got a substantial discount on property. The basic model house was $7,990, which was just a little bit more than 2.5 times the median family income. Imagine if you were going to buy your house for 2.5 times your median income. A bargain, I would venture. And down payments were easy for people who went through the FHA and the VA. And normally they were around $50 to $90 a month if you were paying over 25 to 30 years. Houses that were on sale, when houses went on sale, there were queues around the block to purchase them, and people would sometimes queue the night before. And what they normally got was a lot where you would find trees or an orchard or a potato field. Lots were about twice as big as those in the city centres, and buyers would get a 4-in-1 half room, a kitchen, a living room, 2 bedrooms, a bathroom, an attic, and sometimes even a carport. The houses were built on concrete and with central heating, and often would include such amenities as even television sets, built-in bookcases, refrigerators, stoves, fireplaces, and washing machines. So it was a ready-to-move-into completed house, part of the mass production of post-war America, where everything from TV dinners to homes themselves could be bought off the peg. Okay, so we're going to continue with this one later in the week and look more at American suburbia. But I hope you found this useful. Do remember to follow us on Patreon, and if you can sponsor the podcast at all, that's great. And thanks to those who already are doing, much obliged. Anyway, I hope this has been useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.